This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books Network in African Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Esperanza Brizuela Garcia, and today I will be talking to Professor John Jansen about his book, Health in a Fragile State, Science, Sorcery, and Spirit in Lower Congo, published by Wisconsin University Press in 2019. Professor Jansen is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of Kansas. Professor Jansen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I wonder if we could begin the interview by you telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book.
Well, I begin by saying that I am Emeritus Professor, which means I'm no longer a junior. I've had lots of experience so my 50 years as a university professor and researcher has given me many chapters to look back on. Now, a more focused answer to the question pertaining to this book, I went back to the region in Western Central Africa, where I had done my earliest research. And so in the 60s, from 64 to 66, and again in 1969, I did intensive field research in that region, of the Lower Congo, the Manianga region of the Lower Congo, first for my dissertation and then as a postdoctoral project that resulted in the book, The Quest for Therapy in Lower Zaire. In the meantime, I did a number of projects and mainly having to do with health and healing, I became involved in research projects that tried to figure out what generally was the African traditional approach to healing and how it relates to so-called modern medicine. And then in the course of things, I decided I really wanted to go back to this region where I had a deep knowledge and new people, and I wanted to figure out what had happened during the post-colonial period, that is the roughly 50 years of post-colonial Central Africa. And so I obtained a Fulbright Senior Research Fellowship and made connections with my acquaintances in the Congo region. And I went there and spent 4 months doing what anthropologists do, hanging out, listening to people, talking. I had a proposal, but when I got there, as is also common for anthropologists, the proposals often don't seem to make sense once you get into the community. And things have changed, and they're not exactly what you may think that you would be expecting. And in the case of the Lower Congo, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly Zaire, in fact, I was entering a setting in which there had been what the political scientists and the policy people call failed state situation, the collapse of the state. And so it took me a while to understand how that manifests itself. But in any event, I think I've explained why I researched this project, and that it's a follow-up study to see what has happened to health and healing in the post-colonial period from roughly 1960 or 1965 up to the second decade of the 21st century.
And you know, you presented that, you know, you talked in your introduction precisely about that sort of intervening time, you know, that there was there's a reference to how you found things after not having been there for a period of time. And to some extent, I was wondering as I was reading how that, not just that gap, you know, the fact that you had not been to that region for some time, but what were the things as you encounter them? And like you said, that in some ways you have a plan and then you hit the field and then all of a sudden you have to rethink what is it that you studied and how is it that you're going to explain it or your questions. What were sort of like, what is the difference or how do you felt, how did you feel your questions shifting or changing or your strategies shifting or changing as you first started the field work for this book?
Well, one big difference. So my contacts were people I had known. They were Congolese people. My official point of reference, my official counterpart individual was Mahanya Kimpianga, Jackson Mahanya, a historian who was influential in establishing a regional university and a development NGO, and whom I had known back in the 60s, and I had met him occasionally in between time, and so he also was significant in setting me up, my wife and me up, with connections for the research site. Another individual was a pharmacist and former parliamentarian whom I had encountered along the way as well. So I was going in as a senior peer to a number of Congolese people who were in influential positions. And so my general, shall we say, aura as an anthropologist this time was no longer that of a student, an American student who wants to learn our language and study our history. Let's help him. It became now, you are Professor Jansen, and people were asking me questions as an elder about the olden days. Mm-hmm. And they were often amused because my memory of my earlier fieldwork and my manner of speaking was like that of an old man in their community. So I benefited from being a known professor who had studied their society and was now an elder. the other thing was that in the 50 years since I did my original work, many people now knew what anthropology was. In fact, they knew my work. And so this meant in a lecture that that people would ask me about my anthropological research. I gave a lecture about my work to the university in Lwozi, in the town that I was living in. And one of the professors asked me, "Professor Jansen, this is all very interesting, but what's your research hypothesis, and have you found it proven or disproven?" So it was a very different setting, and the reception was toward me as a senior individual, and I might say in the African setting, elders are generally revered, and so I was getting recognition because of my age, and I don't think in the United States I would necessarily be esteemed because of my age.
Yeah, maybe. Very different
world. I don't know, maybe not. So that's a short answer, many of the people, I did meet people that I had known back then, and I describe a few of these encounters in the book, and they were always very moving, some of them were planned, some were by accident, that is, they were total surprises, and the first reaction was always, "Mr. Jansen, you're old," and my response would be, "Well, so are you," and then we would sort of take it from there.
Yeah, I know. I was wondering also, like you said, you had worked on the questions of health and healing in this region previously. And in the intervening time, you had worked on the sort of like this interface between traditional healing and science or medicine. At what point or how much work had you done before in terms of like the more formal institutions, you know, or when did it start to dawn upon you the importance of institutions, and in particular, like the concept that you obviously introduce in this book is the notion of legitimacy. You know, when it started to dawn upon you that these institutions were vital like you said, the social reproduction of health, and that it was important that they were seen as legitimate.
So when I began to talk to people, I had a list of the kinds of people I wanted to talk to. They were medical doctors. They were people who were in training institutes, and also I was interested in healers, but that was not my primary focus, like at an earlier time. But what I perceived, or what I felt, was that the combination of institutions didn't make sense to me. And previously, there had been a dominant Ministry of Health, National Ministry of Health, and there were state Protestant, Catholic, and independent clinics and hospitals, mostly run by Europeans. Now, everything was being handled by Congolese, but the status of these institutions that I had known previously was now different. The Ministry of Health was virtually invisible, and at the same time, the health zones, that is the primary health care network of public health, public health agencies, was now considered to be the umbrella organization. There had been a restructuring of the whole healthcare system back in the 80s and 90s when the World Health Organization launched Health for All by the year 2000. They, in many countries of the world, they created a hierarchy of local health posts, health centers, and then referral hospitals. And I knew this structure in theory, but when I saw what had happened in the Congo, I tried to imagine how did we get from point A back in the 60s to point B or C, and how did the transition take place? And what didn't make sense to me was that the previous hospitals and clinics run by missions and churches had now been consolidated into health zones in which there was always one referral hospital, maybe several middle-level health centers, and then a bunch of local health posts. But these zones were administered by a variety of agencies. In the case that I was studying, it was a Protestant church medical agency that had been created in, I think, 1993. And the Catholics had a comparable entity. And in neighboring health zones, there were state-run agencies. So the whole formal institutional framework was different. But then what struck me was the real absence of state, so we'll say, services and resources. And when I checked into the state posts and looked at the local government entities, I saw that most of the officials in state offices were doing what has become very common in the Congo and other countries experiencing financial crises. They are off doing other business. They're in private business on the side. And so the offices and the officials had not disappeared, but they were barely paid anything, if at all. They were not in their offices very often. And so the emergence of this new constellation of institutions alongside a, what scholars call a shadow state, was simply a challenge to put together and to figure out. And so when I finished my 4 months, I mean, I had written a number of essays to myself on trying to figure things out, how I would present this. And when I got back home, I gave a lecture to my department in which I proposed four or five possible topics for, let's say, putting this material into book or article form. And the one that intrigued me most, in a sense, was this whole question of how are this new constellation of institutions, of these new institutions, how do they maintain, or how do they achieve some sense of legitimacy, and, or let's say, some sense of enduring sort of power, so that they're not just, you know, like temporary or short-lived or weak and so on. And so I became really intrigued with legitimation theory in the social sciences, and I read a lot, and I spent a very exciting several months at the Max Planck Institute for Social Anthropology in Germany in 2014. And their library had a lot of good work on legitimation theory. So I began to apply some of these ideas for legitimation to the material that I had collected back in 2013. And that's what comes out in the book. Now, I might say that I didn't think that a work on legitimation theory, while it might be interesting to theoreticians, probably would not be a good sort of cover, a title for a book on health in Africa. And so I struggled with how to pitch this. And there's quite a bit of autobiographical material in this book too, especially the introduction, because you know, I'm doing a sort of a follow-up to my earlier research. And so I worked hard at figuring out how to present the material in such a way that it would not be sort of overcharged with theory, would have plenty of good ethnography, would actually clarify what had happened and what it's like to live in a failed state, or let's say a failed state trying to come back to some degree of less failure. So that's my short, maybe too long answer to your question.
No. It reflects quite well in sort of like what we can see in the book, as you both trying to sort of lead us through a series of almost discoveries and realizations in the data that you collected and that it's presented in the earlier chapters, and then at the end sort of realizing that there's something, even though these institutions are there and are serving this population to some extent, there's still fragility, like you use that word, you know, there's still a fragility, and where that fragility comes from has to do precisely with the fact that neither one of these institutions achieves full legitimacy in the way that maybe the state might have done at one point or another. And so I felt like that was a very good way of leading the reader to that late discussion. At the beginning of the book, you start with what you call a baseline, trying to set up a baseline. In the first two chapters, you talk about population decline and rise, and then the post-colonial sort of picture of population in terms of very specific diseases. And it was very interesting to see how, in a way, you were both telling us these numbers are important, population numbers are important, and sort of statistics with respect to specific diseases are important, but they're just a baseline. They don't tell us the whole story. The story of health needs to have a little bit extra. But in what ways did you feel that that baseline was necessary? What did you think that it was helping you tell in the book? And how did you try to go past it?
Yeah. Well, I have. I've taught medical anthropology for several decades, and I developed a textbook on medical anthropology, and I have advised graduate students in this area. And in understanding health or well-being in a society, one sort of obvious point of reference is birth rates, death rates, various cohort groups, and then population growth or population decline. And so I felt I needed to plug in that perspective here to make sense of the whole region. And Lower Congo is a rather in the history of colonial, pre-colonial story of Western coastal Africa. You've got these horrendous sort of eras that begin with several centuries of the slave trade, and this region was a conduit for the slave trade. Then immediately after that, you've got the Congo Free State and the construction of railroads and horrendous sort of population decimation. And so this experience lives on in the memory of people, sometimes unconsciously, sometimes consciously. And then now you have sort of a totally different situation with the World Health Organization kind of calling the agendas, and maternal and child health is really the driver of policies and interventions. And so there's this kind of a all across the board type of demographic manifestation of life situations of the economy and of changing times, and I felt I needed to get a grip on that in order as a backdrop for any discussion of institutions and efforts and changes in the past few years. So I initially wanted to make this a more of a historical book, and by the time I got around to focusing on institutional legitimacy, I had already put together the historical material, and so I thought let's just include it and do the part one of the book chapters 1 and 2, I think, you know, sketches the pre-colonial and the colonial history in chapter 1, and then in chapter 2, post-colonial trends. So, but you mentioned baseline, and as the reader, I mean, as you realize, the data become less and less accurate as you go back. Mm-hmm. And you have to sort of do some fanciful analysis, and then at some point you take that and then you basically conjecture back into the period that, you know, where there is no data at all, or very little data. And I have not yet seen any reviews by, let's say, population historians. I'm sure somewhere there's a scholar who will say, you didn't consult such and such a source. But it is what it is now. And the period during the Congo Free State, where infrastructure developments were being made, like the railroads, and labor was being forced to participate in these construction projects, that's where you had real sort of disappearance of clans, entire communities. And so the most terrible period of all may not have been the slave trade, but the Congo Free State period, King Leopold's period, and Henry Stanley. Henry Stanley was a prominent figure in that you know, period from 1887 through into 1908.
I mean, I felt that those two chapters were particularly effective in setting up some of the questions in the future parts. For instance, in terms of how much can we trust what, for instance, the colonial authorities were telling us about population declines or not. Again, in terms of if we want good outcomes, we need good data, and sometimes even these institutions might not be trustworthy to provide that data. In other words, that institutions matter not just in terms of delivering certain services, but also in terms of allowing us to sort of know what's happening. And in relationship to that, I also felt that these two chapters were very effective. And like you said, in showing us this sort of wider understandings, what might have affected a wider understanding of health in this area. I mean, that these notions of health, not as just the health of the individual, but the health of the individual being very closely connected to the health of the society at large. It was something that was already very very present, or part of the culture of the society, and that was obviously quite traumatized as a result of these experiences during the colonial and pre-colonial periods. Well, and go ahead.
So the colonial archives, that is, not this Congo Free State, but the Belgian colonial archives, they keep records. Their records are basically oriented toward identifying adult male labor, and a steady flow of adult male labor. So they have this category from the 30s, maybe the 20s, 30s on, homme adulte et valable, and from 15 to 45. And that's the labor unit that they're interested in. Now, in order to have a steady supply of labor, you need to have women who are healthy enough to reproduce and, you know, to raise children. And so they keep track of women and children. And generally, for up until into the 50s, their policy is to promote women and children in villages. And the men are expected to either work from home or to go somewhere else to work in projects away from home. And so this policy dictates record keeping, and it dictates a whole lot of other things. And into the 50s and 60s, the records are really very, very good. And I had access to colonial records, and I had access to the post-colonial records. And the colonial method of maintaining records was extended into the post-colonial period for a few years. But eventually, the other feature of this Belgian colonial record-keeping policy was to assume that everybody has a home village, and that's where they are recorded. But they, in a sense, keep a double policy, population records, because they keep track of who's at home and who's away from home. But in about 1965, 67, the African personnel decide that there's way too much work here in record keeping, and they will henceforth begin to keep records only in terms of who is at a given place at a given time. So it's a switch in record keeping and population records that also reflects a much more open policy toward labor and more migration. And but the colonial record keeping reflects the policy on labor and forced or heavy-handed voluntary labor or forced labor on the 15 to 45-year-old male.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah, I understand. No, and it was, like I said, these two chapters were very effective in sort of presenting both the limitations and the advantages of these sources, and like you said, giving us a good starting point. The second part, I felt that it was also sort of moving us from that sort of more general overview of what we could read as health or well-being in the society. It moves us to the specific sites or like the more granular places where we can try to measure what it meant to be healthy in this community. So you talk about the social reproduction of health in part two. And you start with households, families, and then from there you move to institutions and finally end with these very interesting interviews that you conducted about what people felt meant to be healthy personally. So could you tell us a little bit about what you learned in the process of doing this? How do you put together these three chapters?
The intensive sample?
Yes.
After a little while, I mean, after a few weeks, maybe after a month, I became very frustrated with different sources of information, and I decided I need to do what anthropologists often do. They create their own sample. And so, this intensive sample, and I found a few people who helped administer it, and I did a few interviews myself, and I participated in some of the interviews, but it generated really helpful information, and so that chapter on what is health provided me with a really good insight into how people think about these issues. And the case study I developed of a household, of resources that go into health and healthcare, I use the combination of a case study with sample material, and I could reconstruct roughly how far people's incomes reach in paying for the healthcare that they need and want. It turns out that these new institutions, that is the clinics and the hospitals, have to really squeeze their budgets, and so basically the reader ought to come away from this book realizing that there's a lot of good health care available, but people can't afford it. A lot of people can't afford it. And there's no health insurance. And many people are really living from week to week. You have in the Congo what we call a neoliberal economy, where everything is bought and sold at global prices, and people are trying to, work as best they can to figure out how to afford these services, and so the case study presented in the one of the chapters on the social reproduction of health shows that family has it together, but they are, if they would have had one more emergency, they couldn't have paid for it. One more medical emergency, one more serious bout with malaria, or somebody suffering a heart attack or something, or a difficult pregnancy. They have no means to pay for that. Would have had no extra resources. So the getting the anthropologist's dilemma is how do you use the information available to you to reconstruct a general picture that is somewhat representative. And so I used my case studies, I used the intensive sample, I used the records of the health zone, basically I used the government records. I managed to create connections to the office in Lwozi, the territorial office, and they finally lent me their a decade of annual reports, which is pretty amazing. And I spent several days copying information out of those annual reports. You do what you have to do and try not to break the law when you go after material.
Oh, no, but I mean, in a way, it is a very, like I said, there's this feeling as you're reading the book that you understood that there was more to health. There was more to health than simply feeling well, and that that there was a way, there was a need to try to figure out ways of articulating that and figure out what that extra was. And at the end of those three chapters, one can see this, on the one hand, like you said, this sort of rebirth of some kind of institutional framework for the delivery of healthcare, but that in a way, it's still very fragile because it's inaccessible for a very large amount of the population. That even though it exists, it's still not making people healthy, or at least not the vast majority of the people who could use it. And then there's that in that last chapter when you talk about the popular meanings of health, the understanding that again in this society health is not merely it's not just about me or how I feel today, but it's about the society at large. And
as much
that there is a sense of a failed state or a sense of like of the precarity of life, there can be that restitution of a feeling or a sensation of health.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So once you've established that, you move into the deeper level of the problem of legitimacy, and you start that section with this really interesting examination of Dumuna, this ceremony that you use to exemplify some of the so traditional or local ways, or how this particular ceremony has been used to recreate a sense of authority or legitimacy among the peoples of this region. Could you tell us a little bit about this ceremony?
Well, one of my readers of the manuscript was really pleased that I put side by side the scholarly literature on legitimation with the Congo African understanding of these things. So this chapter 6, Dumuna, looks at both the Western scholarship on social legitimation with the Congo African parallel, and in fact there's quite a bit of sort of similarity to them. Mm-hmm. This is important because I want this to be well received within the scholarly community, anthropology, political science, sociology, African studies, and so on, social health, as well as recognized from within the community. I go back to this touchstone ritual of Dumuna, which is kind of esoteric nowadays, but as I research ways in which authority and relationships, society was set up and made proper and corrected, this Dumuna ritual seems to be a kind of signal of putting things right. And so I identify examples within chiefship within alliances between families, within healers' work in sicknesses, and then the whole area of traditional knowledge around the sacred and kisi, and then finally in church rituals, where this ritual dumina has been incorporated into some of the independent churches. But what I'm looking for is an illustration of how power is made, power and coordination of authority are made legitimate or respectable. And this contact of mine, whom I feature here, Mr. Kusikilo, is a brilliant practitioner of power in a relatively modest setting of the local commune. I met him in the 60s. He helped me set up my research in the 60s, and I was able to visit him again now. And so he's one of these figures that I hold up as a great contact and person. Anyway, he shows the way that what happens to power if it is not legitimated, and we're dealing here with a tradition of, well, call it sorcery, call it witchcraft, whatever, but it is nothing other than the exercise of power and influence outside of a recognized civil society. It is selfishness on the part of individuals. It is corruption in a government setting. It is using fear tactics. It is militias forming outside of government and politics. And so the way in which power is institutionalized is really important here to understand the legitimacy of these fledgling sort of new arrangements that health and healthcare are couched in. And so it takes a lot for me to piece this all together, but essentially legitimation theory, scholarly, Western scholarly legitimation theory, and Congo African ideas of power are all helpful in understanding what you should avoid, or how you get to an institution that has the respect of everyone and is going to be efficacious in what it's trying to do.
Yeah, that's that's in a way how you continue to try to ask that question in the following chapter, when we talk about specifically science and sorcery, and how there has been also that attempt to sort of take like local ideas and ideas from science as sources of authority to try to legitimize the different ways in which people seek healing or seek better health. And again, in those instances, uses some examples of medical doctors who at the same time are skilled in so local healing practices. So in a way, you I agree with the reviewer. You do a very good job in sort of showing how these sources of authority and legitimation are not just sort of externally imposed, but very much internally constructed and negotiated. And then you end the chapter with disease control, sort of going back to kind of like the beginning when you talked about it. And just in case we haven't realized how complex this web was, you talk about how even with individual diseases, in other words, legitimation is not just like achieved and done, but it has a different flavor depending on the disease and sort of like the ailment. Can you tell us about that part? It must have been, as you were approaching that section, I'm thinking you were thinking this is more complicated than anybody ever thought.
This final chapter was the most difficult to write because I frankly did not quite know where I was going to come out with this project. But then I felt I needed to produce this chapter because, you know, people could ask, well, so what? You've told us all about legitimacy and you've identified these new constellations and so forth, but sort of what's the point? And the point is that let's say specific institutions are very integral at doing specific things that enhance health. And I did not know this until I looked at my material and looked around and thought about it and tried to connect the dots, that local government maintains sewage treatment. There's no if or but about it. And the mayor of Luozi told me all about annual inspections of pit latrines. And I thought, okay, that's good. But then I began to think, well, this is what keeps us from having all these terrible diseases. And the role of the local mayors and chiefs at enforcing people's, use of pit latrines is a significant layer of disease avoidance. And then you look at water. Here is somewhat similar, but then you ask, well, where do you get your water from? And then people say, well, we have cemented in spring, or we have, we go to the river. But there has been a lot of local government activity involved in maintaining these cleaned up springs and sources of water. And everybody knows that polluted water is going to cause diarrhea, dysentery, typhus, typhoid fever, and whatnot. And so one of the biggest sources of complaints in that section is those people who don't have clean water. And then I really had a fortunate encounter with someone who could tell me how the water system of the city of Luozi actually happened, the political constellation that was required to make it happen, and the whole business of the crocodiles. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, the way this all came together is fascinating, because it took the fear of the crocodiles and it took the elite of the region. It took particular people in parliament to allocate the funds. And then it took the parastatal organization to actually come and do the surveying and find the source of clean water, and then to actually create the facility. So the analysis of institutional legitimacy and viability in relation to health services and infrastructure services, it's critical. And if you don't have this kind of analysis, it's hard to understand why things happen the way they do.
Yeah, I agree. And in a way, that just literally as answered my last question, which is, the importance of this kind of analysis, particularly in relationship to something as health, something mm-hmm. that in a way mm-hmm. People may have ideas about what it is and how it works, but it's not something that individual people can achieve by themselves. It really takes
a
village.
That's true. That's very true. There are things individuals can do, but, the dependence on outside resources here is interesting because the campaign for polio, the campaign, the intervention against sleeping sickness at one point, these all came from the outside, and these links to outside NGOs, the World Health Organization, vitamin A for children, and so on. That's all very well and good, but if the chain is disrupted tomorrow, that will stop, and so there has to be something local and regional in place to make it work. And as I was sitting here this past year in semi-isolation because of COVID, and I was watching the way the United States was handling the reaction to the pandemic, I kept thinking, this is so Congolese. and I began to see, even sort of offices here, my local county commissioners who would not endorse the governor's mandate for masking. And I had to think back at the nativist militia in the Manianga that were refusing to accept any children's medicines from outside because it was foreign. And, I keep thinking, yeah, maybe this is a pretty neat book, but I'm glad you were interested in it and glad you're, we've reached an hour, haven't we?
Yeah, definitely. But before we finish, I just wanted to tell you that I had very much the same thoughts, not because I've been visiting Congo, but precisely because of the way communication and policies have been made. I kept thinking this book, talking about the importance of legitimacy, of the legitimacy of our institutions to enable people to reach good health. It couldn't be more relevant at this moment. I'm not sure that it's just a problem that the United States has had, but it's definitely something that would be relevant for a lot of public health officials throughout the world. So what are you engaged on these days? What is next for you?
Well, partly because of my return visit back in a while ago, I have contacts that are asking me for my material from back when I lived in their village, in their community. I have a contact who's now living in Spain, who was a 12-year-old boy when I did my earliest dissertation research. And he shares anything he can get from me by way of original material, field notes and so on, he shares it with his friends and acquaintances. And so, believe it or not, I am right now indexing my field notes. Well, about 50 years too late, but that's one project. So I'm trying to work with my field material and to make it a bit more presentable. I am also doing occasional chapters for edited volumes. There's a volume coming together about hospital ethnography, and I have a chapter in that in which I compare my Lower Congo material with what I saw in Uganda in 2014. I did a short course in Uganda, in northern Uganda, within part of a Austrian-Ugandan academic exchange. I participated in a two-week course on medical anthropology at the University of Gulu and in northern Uganda, and I picked up some really interesting material on pandemics or epidemic outbreaks in Uganda, specifically an Ebola outbreak in the hospital in northern Uganda, in Gulu, in 2000, and the contrast between a heavily centralized state and the Congo is really intriguing. And so I do a contrast between a shadowy state versus a state that where the central government has its fingers in everything and is running everything, and to see, you know, try to compare and contrast these two situations. So I do occasional special articles or chapters, but my main focus at this point is getting my own material together and maybe working at a more thorough, more systematic presentation of some of my social material from Lower Congo. And we'll see. I keep busy.
Well, that's good. It's very good to hear. I enjoyed very much reading the book, and I'm sure our listeners will do so too. And we thank you very, very much for speaking to us today. And take very good care of yourself.
Okay.
Thank you.